stand here.
Thank you. Now we'll have the question period. While the panel's coming up here, why don't you just stand up and take a break in place? Now the ground rules are that we have the microphones, one here, and I think there's one in the middle there, and one over there, and there are monitors there to help you find them. And when you're going to ask a question, remember that it's being taped, and please give your name and, if possible, your affiliation. Okay, can we sit down now?
You want a drink?
Before we ask for questions from the floor, would any of the panelists like to briefly comment on what the other panelists have said?
I favor beer as a unit. It's two.
I want to know how many barrels of beer there are and a ton of coal, too. Okay, now we have a question. Gentleman back here.
Just as an introduction.
Wait a minute. Give me your name.
Okay, thank you very much. Carl Flick, Westinghouse Electric Corporation. Thanks for reminding me, Mr. Barnes. Just as an introduction, I understand that alcohol is being considered as a very reliable substitute for other kinds of fuels, and I would like to know what the alcohol equivalent would be, but that's only as a starter. Now, having listened to the four speakers, if they have alluded, it has been only very peripherally, to the island country of Japan. It's been my observation that for the last 120 years at least, the history of Japan and the history of the United States have been very closely integrated. From the beginning of the so-called opening of Japan by Commodore Perry for the purpose of, for the intended purpose of opening coal refueling stations, all the way through to present time, where nuclear stations are apparently going up faster there than they are here. I'm not necessarily expecting a question, an answer to this question, but I would like any of the panelists who feel so inclined to comment on the integration between the Japanese economy and the American economy with regard to fuel planning.
Mr. Brennan?
Stand up, I can't see these people.
The Japanese are the largest, apart from the Canadians, are the largest consumers of American coal abroad. The Japanese have invested money in U.S. coal production. The Japanese this year will take somewhere around 20 million tons of coal. All of this is for metallurgical purposes. The Japanese in the last 6 months to a year have been looking very intensively at potential sources of U.S. coal for steam purposes. I think that if you look at integration, the U.S. coal production is absolutely essential to the Japanese steel industry, and we anticipate that there will be increasing interest and perhaps movement of steam coal to Japan. On the other hand, you have to recognize that the degree, the dimension of the volume of move depend more on political rather than economic factors.
Gunning, would you like to comment on that?
Well, the only thing that I would like to say in regard to integration with U.S. policy, up until last year, really, we were not a competitor for the same oil that the Japanese were looking for in the Middle East. This has changed. We are a competitor and a major factor in that market now. And to some degree, we are now, rather than integrating, we're becoming almost antagonists in some respects as far as developing overseas sources of energy.
I think I'd like to add to that that the Japanese, probably more than any other people, need a new source of energy and are therefore doing quite a bit in the nuclear field. In some areas, they're moving faster than we are here in the United States, particularly in high-temperature applications of nuclear power.
I think a number of Japanese companies are also looking for uranium here, aren't they?
Great.
I'd like to make one other comment, if I could, really in response to Jerry Gunning.
One of the issues that's been completely overlooked as we discuss Project Independence is the impact of an America which must increasingly go overseas for energy resources. And as we do, we come into at least a competitive conflict with the industrial nations of the world who need the petroleum from the Middle East much more than we should. But also we become increasingly into conflict with the underdeveloped countries. And there you have a monumental problem because many of these countries simply do not have the wherewithal to pay the type of prices that fierce competition would indicate would have to be paid.
You have another question? Here's one. Your name, please.
My name is Cooper. I'm with the Harza Engineering Company. I'd like to address a question to Mr. Ciaro. What percentage of our petroleum consumption is represented by use of petroleum for surfacing highways and parking lots and such types of use? And following that, would it be practicable to divert that usage to fuel uses and thereby help out our deficiency in petroleum?
It's been a long time since I looked at those statistics, but I think it's something like only 5 or 6% of the oil goes to non-fuel uses, which would include petrochemicals and the like. So I would guess that it would only be a few percent, and somebody else may want to second guess me on that. Also, I think that's kind of a basic residuum from certain crudes. It's probably pretty hard to do much that's useful with it.
yeah, actually, last year we consumed a little over 17 million barrels a day of oil. The asphalt market, if I recall correctly, is somewhere around 125,000 barrels a day. It's quite a small market. And a good part of it, anyway, was supplied by specialty products. You get asphaltic crude from the Caribbean. It's very heavy and is not a good feedstock for utility fuels. It's high in sulfur. Some of it is shipped in a situation where you really almost have to get in with a payloader and dig it out. It's a very heavy stock, and I doubt very much whether a diversion would do much good in this case, and I'm sure it would drive the county and state road authorities up the wall.
I'd like to expand on that question, and Mr. Searle touched on it. We hear much these days of the synthetic materials problem, that there won't be enough oil to provide for the polyesters, and we're going for the new suits and things, and that we're going to have to go back to cotton and other fiber products. He mentioned a very small percentage of the oil used for that. Would you like to expand on that a little bit?
Well, maybe not quite what you were thinking, but according to the National Petroleum Council, a study made a few years back by 140-some geologists, I believe, and I think it's a fairly conservative one, there's something like over 800 billion barrels of oil in place in the U.S. We found about maybe 450 billion of that. We produced about 110 billion of that. Now, of the 450 that we've found, and 110 we produced, we'll add 40 or so to that 110 for reserves. There's still a vast potential, several hundred billion barrels of additional oil, which we know where it is. A good deal of this we can get out with higher prices, for at greater cost rather, and with some advances in the technology of recovery, so-called tertiary and other recovery schemes. And then in addition, there's the amount of the 800 billion barrels that we haven't found yet. I cannot see the time when you can't get more hydrocarbons for a price. Now, you may not like the price. And there's the oil shales beyond that, usually rated at about 2 trillion barrels, but that's only because there's a certain gallons per ton cutoff there. If you want to go into some of the lower grade shales, you can get around 168 trillion barrels. This compares with about 6 billion barrels of oil consumption at present. So I can't see us running out of hydrocarbons. I can see the cost getting, you know, high enough that we'll divert to something else.
Mr. Landis, you were shaking your head. Do you want to comment?
No, I'm just trying to figure out how long that would last.
Any other questions? We have a gentleman back here. I have a question.
I'm Dan Elwing from RTSA, and you were talking today about projections show continued growth of energy demand, and I was curious if money will be available to develop these fuel resources in the future. We haven't talked about the finances of it yet.
Well, this is becoming an increasing problem, but there's one way of looking at it. If the economy of the United States is to grow at a satisfactory rate, and if we're to have relatively full employment and avoid social problems and do all the things that have to be done in regard to the environment and many other things in this country, we're going to have a basic amount of energy input. And this in itself will support an economy of sufficient magnitude to also generate the capital requirements. But if that money is not earmarked, and perhaps on a priority basis earmarked, to developing those energy sources, the economy is just not going to grow at a satisfactory rate and will be in a position of semi-permanent recession. So we're sort of optimistic that if everything goes okay, there'll be enough capital generated in this country to cover the requirements that would be necessary to develop energy resources.
I'd like to comment, if I could, a little bit on that, because traditionally in the coal industry, we generated much of our capital internally. They kept it in a sock or under the mattress or someplace. It looks like for the future, an industry that the capitalization of about $4 to $5 billion is going to have to go anywhere to $20-25 billion. Attracting that capital is a very major task for the coal industry, certainly. And when you talk in terms of, or when you consider rather, that most of that has to be front-ended capital, yeah, it is a problem. I agree with Jerry, however. I think that the capital will be available, assuming a lot of the other things are done. I think you have to say it almost has to be available.
Well, that's what I was trying to get at. And the other thing is that this assumes, of course, that we have a relatively free price system. If we have controls on electricity prices, controls on natural gas prices, on oil prices, coal prices, we may be satisfying short-term consumer aims, but damaging their long-term prosperity. So free market prices would generally be the thing that will bring this capital investment about.
Mr. Landis, you want to comment?
You'll recall that in my list of the nuclear fuel challenges for the 1980s, at the end I mentioned the problem of raising the necessary capital for the expensive undertakings that I had previously mentioned. And I thought that when I invited some rebuttal from the audience, someone would pick this up. I'm glad someone did. I personally feel that raising the capital for the nuclear industry by itself is going to be a tremendous challenge. When you add that to all the capital mentioned by the other people on the panel for the necessary for the other industries, I feel that this may be, just may be, the real bottleneck in our economy in the future.
Let me give you an example of what's happening, capital requirements. A couple of years ago, El Paso announced a coal gasification plant down in New Mexico. At the time of the announcement, we're talking about a 20, 30-year plant, the cost of the plant was $400 million. The latest estimate is $600 million, and they haven't turned a shovel full of dirt yet. Attracting that kind of money for a single plant, and then you multiply it by all you have to do, it just is a major, major problem.
Gentleman back here.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question to direct to
your
Mr.
name, please.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jim Extran, Nebraska Public Power District. I have a question to direct to Mr. Gunning concerning two slides he showed with regard to projected electric consumption in 1985. The first slide was before the so-called energy or petroleum crisis. The second slide showed some decreased projections due to the impact of conservation and the energy crisis. It seems to me that if we are going to meet our energy needs in 1985, and particularly cope with the restricted amount of petroleum we have available, that we're going to have to transfer some of our space heating requirements from the present usage of distillates, particularly, to space heating by electricity, which of course means burning coal and using nuclear fuel instead of electricity. And similarly, in the industrial area, processed steam will have to be produced by electricity rather than the steam that's now being produced by petroleum products. And this would seem to me to indicate that the current energy situation would require increased projections of electric usage in 1985 rather than decreased usage due to our current crisis.
Well, this is true, but you know, when you you take a look at, say, residential electricity costs in the Northeast, and you see the people in my area, New York, for example, talking about annual or monthly electricity bills for heating, running them $300 a month. Obviously, this is going to affect the choice of new construction in that particular area. Now, electric heating has been taking roughly 40%, as I recall in the latest figures, of the new single-family home construction. This was in 73, I believe. We felt that given the new price levels for electricity, plus the semi-controlled price situation on natural gas, and electricity is generally competing with natural gas in many areas of the country for the residential segment, that the growth of electric heating would be adversely affected by the increases in electricity prices. As far as the use of electricity in the other markets are concerned, there is this efficiency factor that we were talking about. As new appliances, as new equipment is brought into service, there is a great deal of incentive to make it more efficient than the older installations. And this has an effect in reducing demand. It doesn't reduce it so much in the industrial market as you might think, because in the industrial market, the growth there is being hypoed by the lack of natural gas that industrial customers previously had sought. Now they'll apparently be looking for more electricity to pick up part of the natural gas gap. But the natural gas situation in the residential market should not be as unfavorable in many areas of the country as in the industrial market. Now, the projections that we used, I would say most people would criticize as being overly optimistic rather than pessimistic as far as electricity is concerned.
Jerry, and you, on that subject, how do you think the heat pump will affect the usage of electricity for space heating?
Well, I think that if anything, this will be the savior of the situation in some areas of the country with more moderate temperatures, for example, where you have this combined heating, air conditioning load.
If I might just give a statistic on this, our company, American Electric Power, has, at the end of last year, and this is, all this data is in their annual report that you can get and verify, had over 220,000 all-electric homes, including heating. The cost of electricity for the year for the all-electric home was $191 over and above the home without heating. Now, our area is where it's cold, but it burns coal, basically. But of course, our coal prices are increasing also, but I don't think they're increasing nearly as much as oil and other prices are. So we see a trend, or at least I do personally, towards more electric heat in our area.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. DeCiano is next back here, I think.
David Safer, a public affairs consultant. I wonder what the panel could tell us about how this nation is going to face into the massive balance of payments problems that our rising petroleum imports are going to cost us.
I'd like to answer that very briefly by saying that the best way to do it is to use fuels that we have here in the United States, and they are primarily coal and uranium.
At the risk of sounding partisan here, and I think I will, it's obvious when you look at the dollar outflow that you're talking about if you increase petroleum imports as we have in the past, that you have to begin to look at areas where America has competitive advantage or comparative advantage in order to counterbalance by increasing exports, and you pretty soon run into a stone wall. More significance, I think, however, is to consider if we continued on the trend that we have, and we get to 1985 and we find ourselves in a position of much more dependence on imports, what happens if politically they get shut off? It's something that is very sobering.
I don't think we can put ourselves in that position. I agree completely on that score, and I think there is a way out, particularly if we turn the generation of electricity over to the fuels that cannot be used for other purposes by and large, and they are, as I said, coal and uranium. I think we would conserve enough of our own domestic petroleum and gas for the uses that peculiarly require petroleum and gas.
As an extension of that part of the question, and if you'll excuse me, Mr. DeCiano, I was going to ask the question a while ago concerning the fact that the Shah of Iran committed 5 nuclear units to a group in France, and this is, I think, purely a matter of the balance of payments. You can't have all export. I had 2 questions.
No, I don't think, Howard, it was all purely a matter of balance of payments. I think he's a fairly far-sighted man, and he realizes that he wants to conserve the wealth of that nation over a period of maybe 1,000 years rather than over a period of maybe 50 years. And if he allows the rest of the world to burn up his precious commodity oil right now, he's going to be a very short-lived bright star on the horizon. He'll be dark and gone by the time some of us die. So, and he doesn't want that. He wants to... He wants to have a strong nation over many centuries, and the only way he can do that is to conserve the petroleum that he has for uses that are much more remunerative to him in the long run. And they include petrochemicals and possibly some very special propulsion applications.
Well, my 2 parts of the question is going to be, do any of you see a possibility that this trend will be taken up by the other oil-producing countries, in other words, buying nuclear plant? And number 2, what's the possibility of the United States getting some of that nuclear business?
I was going to ask Mr. Landis that question.
Well, I think there is a possibility that other countries will follow that leadership. It will be slow in many cases, however. And the chances of the United States getting a good portion of the business, I think, are quite high.
What does this do to our uranium supply, though? I'm kind of pessimistic about this.
Well, it puts more pressure on solving that particular problem. That is a real difficult challenge to meet, and we just have to get out and solve the problem. As I said, there's plenty of uranium in the Earth's crust. We have to find it and produce it on the right time scale.
On the question of who would be looking for nuclear plants, I think it's well to keep in mind that certain countries, like Iran, have a very limited potential as far as oil production is concerned. And unlike Saudi Arabia, for example, their production was expected and is likely to peak within the next 5 or 7 years. So this is on the part of Iran, which has a large population, on the part of Venezuela, which has a large population and limited reserves, on the part of Algeria, which is in the same position, it's a logical move for them to conserve their petroleum resources for more advantageous uses rather than generating electricity. But in the other areas of the Middle East, for example, you have generally small populations, very low electrical requirements, at least thus far, and whether it would be in their interest to go nuclear is very doubtful.
Okay, Mr. DeCiano.
CFPCN, American Electric Power Service Corporation. Mr. Searle interestingly mentioned that the peak of environmental delays seems to have passed for the oil fuels. I wonder if the rest of the panel would care to comment or possibly predict when this peak would occur in the case of the other fuels.
Let me correct my statement a little bit. I think for oil production, I don't know about building refineries yet. We may have some problems with refineries and superports, but for oil production, I think so.
I was really interested in that comment because, you know, we talk, our environmentalists talk to us a great deal, usually in very shrill terms. And they're as mad at the oil industry, well, not quite as mad, but almost as mad at the oil industry toward us. For coal, I guess next year is the time. There was recently passed, and the president signed into law, legislation which would permit the conversion of certain plants from oil to coal based upon very specific conditions. These conditions will apply to a relatively small number of plants. The restraints of the Clean Air Act of 1970 still are due to come in, for the most part, as of mid-next year. The question of moment, and I think the question that the Congress will certainly consider, although probably next year, not this year, is whether or not those restrictions in view of energy shortage are realistic. Nobody knows how the Congress will react. It will be interesting to see what the vote is on the surface mining bill, because for the first time you have a clear-cut case of an environmental question colliding head-on with an energy availability question. It's my own personal belief that the Congress will take a look at and will favorably at least begin to move towards some resolution of the dichotomy between the environment and energy availability with full protection for public health. Whether or not that's going to happen, of course, we'll have to wait and see, but that seems to be the direction, and because you have ludicrous things happening now. Last winter, one of the major utilities in New England was urged by the federal government to convert from oil to coal. They did that. They were in the final processes of converting a plant. They had $20 million in a coal stockpile, which is a nice round number, and then all of a sudden they couldn't get a variance to burn the coal. Now they did, finally, but it took a major effort, and I think you are beginning to see not a retreat from clean air standards, but a recognition that clean air standards cannot be pursued solely in a vacuum, that there are other factors impinging of equal national moment.
On the nuclear side, I would say that, and I hate to say this, but I have to be truthful, I think that we have not yet reached the peak of our environmental delays. I think the emphasis will shift from emission of radioactive material from power plants to other problems, including nuclear safety and release of radioactivity from reprocessing plants, waste disposal, safeguards, and miscellaneous problems like the GAO investigation, the LMFBR, and so on. There are a host of problems in this field, and any one of them provides good fodder for an environmentalist whose main point would be to try to effect delay regardless of what the other consequences would be. And I'm afraid with all of this ripe fruit to pick on, the environmentalists are going to live for a long time.
I think we had a demonstration of that at the equivalent session at the winter meeting. Larry Moss, who was then president of the Sierra Club, was on the panel, and he made the statement that despite the fact that the Sierra Club had just passed a resolution they were against any more nuclear plants, he himself was in favor of them because he thought they were safer than coal-fired plants when you consider death and health considerations in the mining of the coal. And I think
I read that.
Obviously that he's going to be after Mr. Brennan. I think what Mr. Land has said, the environmentalists are going to be here for a long time. We have a gentleman back here, and then we have one over here.
Paul Winkler, Golden Gate Switchboard Company. This is probably a reaction in public domain. To quote Mr. Sandberg, the worried class. If we can believe in the credibility of recent announcements by the media that the terrorist groups have now unified and have sufficient funds and are willing to pay any price for fissionable nuclear fuel, I question Mr. Searle's the advisability of Mr. Searle's suggestion that we have worldwide trading and a futures market in atomic fuel. Would you care to comment on that?
That was not Mr. Searle's remark. That was my remark, so I better take responsibility for it.
Mr. Landis, I'm sorry, yes.
I didn't say exactly what you heard, apparently. I didn't say that we'd have worldwide trading in nuclear, in fabricated fuels. I said in uranium ore.